This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to learn a bit together. What I'd like to do, with your permission, is take a look at a Torah subject. We're talking about anti-Semitism, terrorism, attacks. Let's try to look at the fundamental question of harming other people altogether. The basic subject here is the question of whether one's free will can ever affect anyone else. Try to apply it to the political realm and to the terrorist threat and to the broader threats of war. But fundamentally, the question is, can you really ever affect anyone else? A classic Torah area, very, very difficult area. Some people find this very distressing. But let's see if we can work through it together. I wrote a book about this recently that's called Will, Freedom, and Destiny, that has a long section on this. And although it's a very difficult subject, I think if you buy two copies, then you'll understand it very well. The question is really, can you affect anyone else? Classic and extreme example would be, could somebody kill someone else if there's no din, no gzerim in a shemayim, no heavenly decree on the victim? That's the classic formulation of the question. We're not talking here about divine foreknowledge. What Hashem knows beforehand is way above the subject. That's, if you think this subject is difficult, try that one. We're not talking here about what Hashem knows beforehand. We're talking about what's called a gzerim in a shemayim. Without going into the technicalities, a decree, a heavenly decree. Could someone kill someone else if it's not decreed for the victim to die? That's the question. On the one hand, you have free will. You can use it in the world, affect other people. On the other hand, surely the victim only gets what's coming to them. Surely Hashem is protecting you. There's Hashkocha. He's watching over you. Surely you'll only get what you deserve. This is the classic problem. Clash between Bechira and Hashkocha. My free will to act as I wish and your protection, divine oversight, whatever you want to call it. The problem is what happens when those two conflict. Let's make it clear. Mr. A is walking down the street. You interview Hashem. Hashem, how do you feel about Mr. A? Hashem says, he's cool, he's fine. No decrees against you. As far as I'm concerned, 25 years to live, he can get married, have a family. At that point in the discussion, Mr. B turns the corner and tries to kill A. We have a problem. There's no decree on A to die. Can B kill him? If you say no, he can't kill him because Hashem hasn't decreed it, you're pulling the teeth of the free will of A. B, which whoever it is, the aggressor. And if you say that he can kill him, that's a very scary proposition. He's killing somebody that Hashem did not decree to die. Do we see the problem? How come they see it and you don't? That's the problem. In order to approach this question, let me set up a scenario that we'll use as a framework. Fascinating question. And then we'll work through the subject and try to circle back to that. Here's the question. Listen carefully. Fascinating dilemma. Many years ago, during the life of the Pesachei Tshuva, you can look this up, it's in Choshen Mishpat Yudches, he was faced with the following question. One of the senior rabbinic figures of that generation, very learned Talmid Chacham, was visiting a commercial expo, I think it was in Leipzig, where Jews got together to buy and sell. And the way they resolved conflicts there was, in typical fashion, they made a beis din. If there was litigation between two Jews, they would co-opt three members onto a beis din, and they would hear the case. Even the non-Jews there subjected themselves to the same arbitration. And on this occasion, he was visiting, and two Jews had a problem. So they selected two people to be on the beis din, and they co-opted him to be the third dayan. He was a very well-recognized authority. They couldn't very well not do that. Put him on the beis din. And he writes to the Pesachei Tshuva the following amazing question. He said, the evidence began to be heard, and it became immediately apparent to me that the other two judges were lying. They were colluding dishonestly against the innocent party. They had no intention of voting for the truth. They would vote in an illicit fashion. Money would change hands in the wrong direction, and I will be carried along in that miscarriage of justice. You know, in halacha, a judge who dissents may not even say that he dissented. Here in America, when the Supreme Court makes a decision, you have a learned dissenting opinion. The minority opinion writes why the others are wrong. In Judaism, you're not allowed to do that. When three of us sit on a beis din, I sit with two others. If I vote for you and they outvote me, I'm not allowed to go to you afterwards and say, well, I was on your side, but they outvoted me. You can't do that. The ruling comes down as unanimous fiat of the Beis Din. The majority annuls the minority and is one ruling. So I'm truly carried along in this judgment. What am I going to do? I'm going to sit there and vote. They'll outvote me. It'll be a travesty of justice, and I'm party to that. So he sat there thinking about it, and he thought to himself, well, I have an option. I can say, I don't know. The Shulchan Aruch says, the way you recuse yourself from a case in Judaism, you say, en eni yodeh, I don't know. If a judge says he doesn't know, the case is closed. A technical reason is because now you have two judges left, and in halacha, you cannot have an even number of people on the base team. Why an American jury has 12 people, I've never figured out. It's a recipe for trouble. But we can never have a balanced base team. There always has to be an odd number. And therefore, you leave two, the case is invalid. So I can say, I don't know. But his dilemma was, he said, that in order to say, I don't know, he would have to lie. Because he didn't know. What does Torah require from me? Does the Torah require me here to lie and have a truthful result? Or does the Torah require me to say the truth and have a false result? Isn't that an amazing question? Isn't that an amazing question? You have to enjoy the question. And remember that the truth in Jewish law is always contextual. The truth is always in terms of the situation. It's not the legalistic naked meaning of the words. The concept, the context is always important. You're sitting at home. The phone rings. Your wife picks it up. From her tone of voice, you realize this is someone you don't want to speak to. So this is what you do. You step out and you say, I'm not in. Your wife says, I'm sorry, he's out. Is that truth or a lie? Our poskim, we talk about this, say that's a lie. The question wasn't which side of the doorstep your husband's standing on. That's not the meaning of the question. It's better to stay in the room and say you're not available. You can't get away with that. And therefore, what is the truth in this situation? Should I vote for the truth and have a lie result? Or should I say false and have a true result? Amazing question. So he said, he sat there and he thought about it, and he came up with a precedent. The precedent was as follows. And he writes this in his question. The precedent is this. You know, when a Beis Din, let's say the Sanhedrin judges a capital case, let's take that case. The Sanhedrin, 23 judges, or 71, they judge a capital case, which is almost impossible to get a conviction in Judaism. But they're judging the case. There are some very unusual laws that the non-Jewish world does not recognize. You need not a simple majority to convict, you need more than that, all sorts of stringencies to get a conviction in a capital case. But one of them is extremely peculiar. And it's the rule that if there's a particular majority that convicts, that in Jewish law paradoxically acquits. If you have that particular proportion of judges saying the person's guilty, he's free. Without going into the technicalities, if it's a murder case, he's not free, but he doesn't get one of the four pieces based in. If it's not a murder case, he's free. Which proportion is that? If 100% of the judges judge he's guilty, he's free. Make sense? Well, one of the reasons is that if no one could argue in his favor, nobody could try to defend him, we're concerned they didn't examine the case well enough. First of all Jews agree is definitely very problematic. I mean, that's definitely not normal. But if nobody could speak in his favor, we are concerned that the case wasn't examined, and if they all say guilty, he's acquitted. Now, imagine this. The Sanhedrin is sitting. This person's on trial for his life. It's a capital case. You are all members of the Sanhedrin. I'm sure you're all black belt halakhic authorities. I'm sure you're all duly qualified to be members of the great Sanhedrin. They sat in a semicircle so they could all see each other. And the voting went from junior to senior. Right? What was the reason for that? They didn't want a junior to be influenced by a prior senior vote. So they would begin with the junior and they would move towards the senior vote. Let's say the vote goes like this. You're all members of the Sanhedrin. We start with a junior. We move through to the senior authority. What happens in the following case? Person's on trial. The evidence has been heard and the voting goes like this. Guilty, guilty, execute, death, guilty, guilty. And the whole Sanhedrin votes guilty till we come to the final, great, ultimate black belt. Mufle Shabbos, the great halakhic authority of the generation. And he knows that the person's guilty. But if he says guilty, the man will be freed. What should he say? If he says the truth, a falsehood results, a criminal walks free. Should he say the truth to have a false result? Or should he say false He should say innocent to have him convicted, which is the truth. What would you say? And by the way, there are two versions of this. Two versions. One is when he knows the man is innocent and he's convicted. And one is when he knows he's guilty. Let's say he knows he's guilty. And they've all said guilty. If he says guilty, he'll walk free. Maybe you should say innocent to have him convicted, because you need at least one vote in his favor to have him killed. It could work in both directions. The Rochaim has a wonderful piece on this. What should he say? So the Rambam, what would you say? What is MS? Of course he has to say MS. What is MS? The Rambam writes that he has to say what he sees. Lefi mashe einav royeh. The judge has to say the truth as it appears to him, and the consequence is his problem, not mine. The Torah says, you make a judgment. You say guilty, they all say guilty, he's freed, that's his problem. That's the precedent. So he said, if that's the case, I'm sitting on a Beis Din, there are two other judges, they're lying. Speak the truth. The result is wrong, not my problem, it's his problem. Says the Pesachei Tshuva, wrong. These two cases are not parallel. One has nothing to do with the other. Let's explore this subject, and we'll try to use our knowledge to come back and understand the resolution of this issue. But our fundamental question is a voyage here. Let's take a voyage through this fascinating area. Can one person's free will affect another? And by the way, it doesn't only mean to harm someone, it could mean to help someone too. You try to give stock or charity to somebody who needs it. There's no way you can give him money if it wasn't predestined for him. This person has his hashkacha, a certain amount of money that he needs. It was predetermined at Rosh Hashanah. He's not going to get a penny that he doesn't deserve. You give stocker to him. How can you affect his dispensation? How can you interfere with his hashkacha? It would seem that there are only two possible approaches. Approach number one, you never touch anyone else. All you can ever do is make the decision. A tries to kill B and B dies. The only feasible interpretation is that A pulled the trigger, took responsibility, is guilty for murder, but B would have died anyway. That's one interpretation. That's wonderful in terms of the victim. It means nothing ever happens to you that wasn't going to happen anyway. Very comforting. But it takes the potency of free will out of the world. You never affect anyone. Of course you killed him, and of course you're guilty for murder. You'll be tried. But the point is, you never did anything that wouldn't have happened anyway. That's one interpretation. And by the way, we do not respond to the world intuitively that way. This evening when you leave here, you get in your car, some careless person backs right into and makes a big dent in your car. You get out and start yelling and screaming. Well, you Americans, you get out and say good evening. And you say to the person, look what you've done to my car. And he says, you're an Orthodox Jew, aren't you? You say yes. He says, well, you must believe you had it coming. I'm not sure. We don't relate to the world that way. But we'd have to say that's the truth on this. But there's another possibility. The other possibility is that you could affect someone in a way they don't deserve. The one possible interpretation when A kills B is that B was not going to die then. And A killed him. And his wife's a widow because of the action of A. That's very scary. That's very empowering in terms of the free will of the actor. But it's very scary in terms of the victim. I think if you do a survey in the Jewish world, the knowledgeable world, the Orthodox world, people will tell you the first interpretation is the correct one. How many people would agree with that? I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong. I don't know any Torah source that says that. There are countless sources that say the opposite. That you could affect someone indeed in a way that's not appropriate under very specific circumstances, but you could. In fact, I'm not aware of a single source that says the opposite. If you read the chapter in my book, you'll see many, many sources documented. If you email me, I'm happy to send you more. A wonderful piece on this from Rav Gurwitz from Gateshead, and many, many, many sources on this. But let me share with you a few proofs. And again, I'm warning you, it's a distressing subject. It needs to be understood carefully and deeply and accurately. Let me share with you a few proofs. I'll give you one beautiful, succinct, very brief proof that I heard from Yaakov Weinberg from Baltimore, but I've seen it written. Here's what he says. I'm going to prove to you that you could do something to somebody that's not appropriate, more than they deserve. We say, Vayomer David El Gad. David said to God, Nipla na beyad Hashem, let us fall into Hashem's hand, ki rabim rachamav, because his mercy is great. Ubayot Adam Alepola, let me not fall into human hand. Very telling. David HaMelech is given a choice. Hashem says to him, David, you need suffering.
How would you like your suffering? Would you like a plague and an epidemic and illness for you and your people?
Or would you like an enemy attack? David says, Hashem, I'll deal with you. I want the illness. That comes from your hand. It'll be merciful. There's no trusting a Philistine soldier. That is very revealing. If you believe you only get what's coming to you, flip a coin. What's the problem? Every Philistine sword has your name written on it. Every bullet has a name on it. What's the difference? Flip a coin. You're only going to get what you deserve. No. David says, Hashem, I'll take the illness. That comes from you. That'll be appropriate. But a human could do more to me than I deserve. Very beautiful proof. Once you see this, you start to see it everywhere. I mean, Rav Steinman said recently, right? I thought of this myself, actually, and someone told me recently he said this. We've just been through Pesach. The classic question that the Rambam raises, the Ramban as well, how could the Egyptians be punished for torturing us, for enslaving us, when it was predicted? Again, this is not the problem of foreknowledge. That's one problem, but the Rambam details the second question. This was not just divine foreknowledge. This was announced as a prophecy. It was open knowledge in the world. There'd been a prediction, a prophetic prediction, that the Jewish people would be enslaved. A nation arises and enslaves them. How can you punish them? They're doing Hashem's will. They're doing what Hashem had announced was to happen and needed to happen. They should claim reward. There are many answers to this, but listen to one of the Ramban's answers. He says the Egyptians were not punished for enslaving the Jewish people because it was predicted and necessary. And they were only punished for the excess suffering they caused. They caused the Jews more suffering and torture than was destined. Oh, so you can cause people more suffering that is destined. According to this answer, there are others, but according to this answer, the Egyptians were not punished for what they did to us. That was predicted. They were punished for the more that wasn't predicted, that wasn't decreed. So you could do to somebody more than is decreed. There are many, many Torah sources for this. But let me share with you the classic. Because without studying this source, we would not be doing our job professionally. And that's the classic Or HaChaim. In fact, it's a Zohar. The Zohar says it in great detail. It's a whole page in the Zohar. The Or HaChaim doesn't quote the Zohar, but he goes through it in detail. And here's the Or HaChaim. But people think it's Or HaChaim. The Oshet says the same thing. The Netziv says the same thing. The Malbim says the same thing on the same place. They all say it. And by the way, no one argues with Or HaChaim. No one since his day has said he's wrong. No classic source. The Or HaChaim says this. When the brothers sold Joseph, you know the story, they saw him approaching and they said, behold, this dreamer of dreams approaches. Let's kill him and see what becomes of his dreams. Says the Or HaChaim, they were not being childishly sarcastic. They meant this. We understand that Yosef has had dreams that we will bow down to him in the future. We hold that as an imposter. The dreams are false. He's a liar. He's a threat to us in our future. We need to kill him without going into all the problems of how brothers could make a Beis Din on our brother and all sorts of difficulties. They decide they have to kill him. But they said to each other, how do we know that we are correct? How can we be sure we administer justice correctly? And the answer was, of course we can. If we kill him, there'll not be a future in which we'll bow down to him. Because he'll be dead. And therefore, not only will justice be done, it will be seen. Is this clear? Joseph is born here. Age 17, he has dreams that somewhere in the future we'll bow down to him. Well, if we kill him now, there ain't going to be a future in which we'll bow down to him. So it'll become apparent now that his dreams were lies. Is this clear? So all we have to do is kill him, and we'll be vindicated immediately. Reuven stepped forward and said, gentlemen, you're making a basic hashkafic error. You think that if you kill him, it will vindicate your case. I'm telling you that human free will is so powerful. Hashem created the world for that. He could have had true dreams, but if you act against him, you raise your hand against him, Hashem will allow you to kill him, because that's what the world was created for. If human free will is powerful enough to do that, he will wrongly conclude that he was guilty, and you'll be wrong. So the brother said to Reuven, what should we do? He said, don't touch him. Throw him into this pit of snakes and scorpions. Now, the Maharal points out that this pit was not full of snakes and scorpions. The Mishnah says if you throw a person into a pit full of snakes and scorpions, that's murder. That's direct action. It's like somebody holding someone's head underwater. I didn't kill him. It was only the lack of oxygen. No, you can't get away with that. A long discussion in Sanhedrin. How direct does your action have to be? But the pit was not full of snakes and scorpions, but it had enough snakes and scorpions to be dangerous. So Reuven said, put him into the pit. Here's the message. No self-respecting scorpion. He's going to touch you unless your name is decreed on his sting. He doesn't have free will. The Medrash says before they put Yosef into the pit, they set their dogs on him. The Medrash Rabbah says they put it because dogs have no free will. They wanted to see what would happen when a non-human agency is ranged against you. The message, says the Rav Chaim, Reuben was not trying to save Yosef from his fate. He was trying to save him from the hand of human free will. From his fate, Hashem will give him whatever he needs. But human beings, that could override God's destiny. He says very beautifully, "Vayatzilehu miyadam," says the Rachaim. He saved him miyadam from their hand, from the hand of human free will. Miyad habechiri. He was not trying to save Yosef from danger. He was trying to save him from the hand of human free will. Very beautiful, classic demonstration. All our commentaries say the same thing. This is the classic locus in Torah. There are many others. But this is the classic source which is used to demonstrate that you could do something to a human being using your free will that might not happen otherwise. We don't have time this evening. There are many, many sources. I'll just share with you one more very interesting one. Here's one, beautiful one. I think it's the Alshik who says this. When King Darius wanted to kill, or at least endangered Daniel, you know, Daniel was an advisor in the court of Darius, who was Esther's son or grandson. The courtiers were jealous, as often happens. Daniel was a privileged advisor to the king. They maligned him to the king, and they said he's a traitor. So the king said, no problem, I'll throw him into a den of hungry lions. Daniel in the lion's den. I'll throw him into a pit of hungry lions and see what happens. I hold that he's a spiritual giant. He'll be saved miraculously, like Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were spiritual giants, they were saved. He'll be saved, I have full confidence. If you write he's a traitor, he'll be eaten by the lions. So listen to what the passage says. It says the king threw him into the pit of lions and sealed the mouth of the lion's den because he was afraid that the jealous humans who were his enemies would kill him, they'd shoot arrows at him, throw their spears at him in the lion's den, and then he was eaten by the lions, say the lions had done it. The pasuk says that. Says the Al-Sheikh, notice what's happening. He's not afraid of hungry lions. The king is totally confident that Daniel will survive among the lions. The problem is human beings. All bets are off when it comes to humans. He throws him into a pit of hungry lions, then no problem, but he has to protect him from jealous humans who might kill him. They could kill him even though he's meritorious enough to be saved by lions, miraculously. Very extreme and beautiful proof. And there are so many proofs on this side that you could actually do something to someone who is, in the language of the Rahim, that someone could kill someone else who does not experience a divine decree of death. That's his language. Okay. Scary? There are many modifying factors. I don't want to keep you too late. Let's just mention a few variables that reduce the gap. We are not saying that a human being has carte blanche to do anything to anyone under all circumstances. We're not saying that at all. Under certain specific circumstances, a person could do something to someone else that is not decreed. What are the limitations? The first of them, by far the most important, schus. What's the merit of the recipient? If the person has enough merit, you will not touch them. If the person is defended by spiritual merit, no matter what you do, they will only get what they deserve. The classic example, of course, is ultimate schus. We call that Tzadik Gomor. Classic example in history is Mordechai. Mordechai decided to sit where Haman was walking and refused to honor him, to drive him into such an anti-Semitic frenzy that Haman would self-destruct. But that's a very dangerous game. Very dangerous. The principle governing in Jewish history, at least post-prophetic Jewish history, is Eretz Nitna Biyad Rasha. Eretz Nitna Biyad Rasha. The world is given into the power of the wicked, in case you hadn't noticed. The world is not being run by benevolent politicians who care about your welfare. Even you Americans. The world is being run by people who will kill you for far less than a vote. Sorry to have to tell you that. Eretz Nitna, but the world is in the hand and the control of the wicked. And therefore the post-prophetic strategy, we walk between the raindrops. We use strategy. We don't make full frontal attack on the evil. To stand in Haman's way and drive him crazy, very risky. But Mordechai knew he was impervious. He knew he had enough schus, based on historical reasons and various, he knew. So if you have enough schus, you could never be affected. Meaning if you are, it's not he who did it, you had it coming. The problem with Yosef was maybe he's not a tzaddik gamur. Maybe he's vulnerable because he spoke about his brothers. Therefore they could kill him even if he doesn't deserve to die. That a vulnerability has been opened. And therefore, here's the message. You could be affected by someone else in a way that you don't deserve, to the extent that you lack the merit to protect you, and to the extent that the aggressor has free will. We're not talking about a 14-year-old Arab who's sent into a bus with a bomb on his back. We're not talking about that. We're talking about big people. There's no accident that Rahim teaches this in the context of the brothers of Yosef. You have to be big enough. You have to be someone big, for better or worse. There's a tussle here between the human free will of the aggressor and the schus of the recipient. That's the most important variable. By the way, it doesn't have to be your schus, it could be your wife's. Mr. A is walking down the street, B tries to kill him. Maybe Mrs. A doesn't deserve to be a widow. Your mother, your wife. This is the reason that some people do not take out life insurance. By the way, you should take out life insurance. It's very important. My son sells it. You should see it. It's very important. Every young couple getting married should take out life insurance. It's very, very important. But some people rationalize like this. Why should I take a life insurance? Mr. A is walking down the street. He has no life insurance policy. Mr. B is about to kill him. Hashem looks down and says, I can't allow that. His wife needs him. He's the one who brings home the bacon. Whatever he brings home. His wife needs him. And therefore Hashem will protect him. But if Mr. A is walking down the street and he has a $100 million life insurance policy and B tries to kill him, Hashem's going to look down and say, your wife's okay. In some cases, she's probably better off. Knowing some husbands. This is a good strategy for making yourself as indispensable to as many people as possible. You should single-handedly support so many poor families that when you're walking down the street and someone tries to rub you out, Hashem's going to look down and say, you know what, it's just too complicated. I'll put up with you in the world a little bit longer. It's not the highest motivation for stocker, but it's kosher. That is the rationale for schus protecting you. And there are many others. Your schus protects you. This does not apply to groups. The Alshri is very clear about this. This problem of being affected by someone's free will applies only when an individual is targeted by malicious action. Not a bomb thrown into a bus or a group of people. By the way, what is the destiny of a group? Rabbi Chana Wasserman has an amazing piece on this. When a group of people is threatened, what's the calculus? He says it depends. When a ship is sinking, there are two possibilities. Either everyone on that ship had the same date of death, so they were invited on the same cruise. In Talmudic language, that's called Mazminam Lepundak Echa. They were all invited on the same cruise because they're all day of death the same. Or it could be that someone there needs to die and the others are just in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's called Oile Rosh, Oile Shechena. Needs understanding, that's what it says. Big difference. Scenario number one, trying to get out of there is not going to help you. You were invited there for a reason. Number two, get out of there, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Third, wars. All bets are off. Milchama Sani Asisi, the destiny, the dispensation in wartime has got a completely different calculation. Fourth, mass disasters. Holocaust-type situations, now, maybe. Completely different variables. There the Gemara says, Kivan shen nitten reshus lemashlis lahashlis, when permission is given to the destroyer to destroy, shuv enoi mafkin bein tzadik l'ra. Makes no distinction between the righteous and the wicked. Another whole issue to understand. Fifth, kings. A king, a prime minister, a president, a mayor of a major city, somebody with major political power. No free will at all. Leiv melech b'yad Hashem, leiv melochim v'sarim b'yad Hashem. Pasuk says, the king's heart is in Hashem's hand. No human being has free will to affect the masses. When a person is prime minister or president or a king and he makes decisions that affect many, of course he's accountable. But the people only get what they deserve. The irony in Western society is that when a person is elected president, he thinks, or she thinks, that they have real power. But in Jewish vision, they just became a puppet at that moment. And their heart's in the hand of Hashem. By the way, this is why it makes no difference who you vote for. You're going to get what you deserve. Your vote makes no difference. Why should you vote? Because it's shtadlus. You have to make an effort. It's a civic duty. You have to vote. But it doesn't make a difference. Making an effort to vote, fine. But to go crazy like they're doing the elections and get dead people voting. This is not necessary. Not necessary. So these are some of the variables that govern the limit. These are some of the things that limit one person's free will to affect another. So what have we said? One person can do something to somebody else under certain specific and very limited circumstances, theoretically, where the person did not have that decree before. Let me put it more accurately, right? Chaim Friedlander puts it this way, and Moshe Shapiro clearly explains it this way. You can affect someone in the following way. You can put someone in a situation of danger. That you can do. In the situation of danger, a decree needs to be issued. The books are opened. A is walking down the street. B pulls a trigger. He creates a situation of danger. In that situation, like any situation of danger, the Gemara says the books are opened. Do you deserve to be saved? A woman in childbirth, a person going through an operation.
in Talmudic language, a person walking under a leaning wall. Hashem opens the books. Do you deserve a miraculous salvation? If you do, you get saved. The decree is issued. If you don't, then not. So when we say someone can affect someone else, we mean you can put someone in a situation of danger that opens the books of your merits and demerits. And in that situation, an issue, a decree has to be issued. So far, so good. Let's come back and close the circle. I'll add just one more dimension, and then we'll try to apply it to our original case. And I'm sure you'll see it clearly. The Chinuch says this very clearly. I don't have time to go into it fully. I'll give you one example in the Chinuch. There is another which you can look up yourself, Resh Mem Aleph, Resh Mem Beis. There he talks about the prohibitions of revenge and bearing a grudge. I won't burden you with that. Look it up. It's a very challenging language. How does it fit into our thesis? I'll leave that to you to solve. But let me tell you the classic source in the Chinuch that says very clearly what we are saying. In Taf Kuf Chaf Dalet, the Chinuch says the following thing. You know, in Judaism, we have a rule called Edim Zonimim. Without going into all the details, unlike in non-Jewish law, there's a unique situation in evidence as follows. Let's say this person's on trial for his life. Two witnesses say he murdered, and two say that he didn't. Case closed. We don't know who's telling the truth. But if two witnesses say that he murdered, and two others come along and say, we don't know about the murder, but you witnesses are lying. You witnesses could not have seen the crime. You were with us at another place at that time. Then we have a unique outcome. What do? We spare the life of the person who was accused, and we do to the two accusing witnesses what they tried to do to the victim. They wanted to make him pay money, they pay money. They tried to have him killed by framing him, they get killed. That's the law. For homework, try to figure out why do we believe the second two? Who says that they were framing him? Maybe they're framing them. Okay, logical question. But listen to this quirk. Very challenging postulate of the Torah. We listen to the second two witnesses, and we do to the first two what they tried to do to the victim, only if they were not successful. If they were successful, no problem. Is that weird? Again, these two witnesses say that this person killed. We hear the evidence, he's marched out to be killed, executed. On the way to the execution, two others arrive and say, they're lying! Stop the execution, we bring him back, we hear the evidence, found to be true, the accused is freed, and these two people are killed. Why? They tried to kill someone in illicit fashion, they get killed. What happens if these two testify that the person killed, and we march him out to execute him, and he's executed, dead? Then two others rush in and say, stop, they're lying! Too late, he's dead. And they then testify that these two are lying. Do you know what we do? Nothing at all. Freed, no problems, got free. 1 second. They try to kill someone and failed, they get killed. They illicitly try to kill somebody and have him killed, no problem. Is this weird? Weird? The Maharal has a wonderful explanation. It's a very amazing and mysterious subject. Listen to the Chinuch. But listen carefully. It's demanding, but it's worth the effort. Says the Chinuch, I will give you katsas tam. I'll give you half a reason. Do you know why if the person was killed, we do nothing to the people who framed him? Because if he died, he must have had it coming. If he was killed, he must have had it coming. What do you want from these people? He died, didn't he? Does this support our thesis or run against it? And then he adds a line, which inverts the thing completely. He says, listen well. He says, do you know why if the person's killed, we can rest assured that he had it coming? Because this is a Beis Din, a Sanhedrin. And Hashem assures the outcome of every Sanhedrin. He quotes the verse, Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Keil. We say it every Tuesday. Hashem sits with every Beis Din. He quotes the verse like this, Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Hadayonim. Hashem sits with every Beis Din, every Sanhedrin. In fact, the Rambam writes that the only reason that humans can administer justice in the first place is because Hashem guarantees the outcome. How can you be sure your justice is true? Hashem says, never mind, go through the motions, I'll assure the outcome. There's a principle in Judaism that God himself, Hashem himself, sits with every Beis Din, every Sanhedrin, and guarantees the outcome provided you follow the rules correctly. And therefore, if the person died, he must have had it coming. You know why? Because Hashem was present with this Beis Din and assured the outcome. Now listen well, we do what's called a diuk. Diuk means an inference. You know why we know this person must have had it coming and all is well with the justice? Because this is a Beis Din. That's what he said.
But if this weren't a Beis Din, it was an individual acting on his own in the street, or better off, it could go desperately wrong. Isn't that what he's saying? If the chinuch means that anything that ever happens to anyone is always appropriate because it's decreed, you don't have to quote me the verse about Hashem sitting with the Beis Din. He's clearly telling you that you can rest assured that the outcome is appropriate and totally just because Hashem assures it. Only a situation of Beis Din, that's where the guarantee exists, meaning all other situations are not guaranteed. Did you see that? It's amazing. And therefore, the chinuch clearly understands that with the exception of situations like a judicial situation, you could certainly affect someone in a way that's not appropriate. The only place you can be sure that the outcome is appropriate is in Beis Din. Let's come back to our original point. Says the Pesachei Tshuva, beautiful. He says, when you're sitting in a Sanhedrin and the last Dayan has to vote and he sees that the victim's guilty, speak the truth. Say what you have to say. He gets acquitted. There's a Beis Din. Hashem is sitting here. It shows the outcome. But you're sitting on a Beis Din with two liars. This ain't no Beis Din. You're sitting with two jokers. You're not sincere. Hashem doesn't sit with people like that. Get out of there. That's what he says. If you're in a Beis Din and you disagree with the judges, convince them. You failed, vote. You outvoted, that's fine. But you don't hold they're wrong. You hold they're lying. There's not a Beis Din. There he says, say you don't. Anyway, that's very clear and very beautiful. So what did we learn this evening? We learned that, I believe, the correct approach to this dilemma is that you can make a difference to other people. Of course, legally it makes no difference. Whatever you do, you're accountable for. Of course, that's true. That's why this point isn't pushed more irrelevant practically in terms of a din. But you have to know you affect other people. When a tragedy, lo aleinu, occurs and a bomb goes off and people are destroyed and so forth, every person was there because he needed to be there. I know it's very difficult to understand. It's wrenching, it's agonizing. We feel much worse when people are harmed by other people than when it's disease or some natural. There we can see Hashem is doing it directly. Even there it's hard enough. But when people are killed by other people or harmed by other people, it's much harder to see. But with the exception of the unique situation of one person targeting another with all the provisos that we have mentioned, of course, our attitude has to be, with all the difficulty and all the suffering, that Hashem knows what he's doing, and this was, whatever word you want to use in English, destined or needed to be, or the person's time, obviously that's true. But beyond that is a notion of human free will being so powerful that it controls destiny. That's how powerful it can be. You have to rise to the occasion, of course, you have to be somebody big enough. And the attitude we should take, of course, is that when you help someone, right, you have to be a powerful enough actor in the world that you genuinely make a change. That's the power you have in your hands on both sides of the account. And therefore, I think this is the right approach to this subject. I think this is a deeper vision than the sop that is usually given that was meant to happen anyway, and it never did it. I think this is the way to do it. So, if you want to see more, there's, as I said, an excellent book on the subject. You take a look there. Thank you very much.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.